Thanks, Bob. Welcome, everybody. And I hope you're enjoying the book so far. And today we'll be working on chapter 8. And if next time you could read chapter 9 and the epilogue, because we'll be winding up next week. So I thought I'd begin with how I originally learned so much about this way of loving that we're describing. It was from a Buddhist practice which is called loving kindness. So this is you right here in the center. And then there are concentric circles of love around you. The first circle of love is made up of your family and friends, people that you know and love dearly. Then come the people that you see and you have some contact with. They are kind of neutral in your life, but you have interactions with them, but you wouldn't quite call it a relationship. Then there are people, and I know this fits for some people in here, with whom you have some difficulties. And sometimes they even feel like enemies, or they feel like people that don't like you or you don't like them. And finally, are all people all over the globe. So this would be, shall we say, the way it's put in Buddhism is all beings. And in this practice of loving kindness, you begin with loving yourself and extending this love to those you care about, then to those to whom you are indifferent, then to those who feel like enemies or people that are unlikable, and finally to everyone. And the goal is to have the same kind of love in each of the concentric circles. So I love myself equally to the way I love those who are near and dear, equally to those who are indifferent, and so forth. Combination of I wish them good health and happiness, freedom from suffering. I have goodwill toward myself, toward others, and so forth. And I act toward them with goodwill. I show goodwill toward everyone, and I even extend compassion if they are suffering. And I have made a commitment never to retaliate if any of these people hurt me. I will instead say, ouch. I will be assertive enough to speak up in anger, but I will find a way to work things out. This, in Buddhism, is called loving kindness practice. You might also see it as metta, which is a Sanskrit word for it. And basically, I see this as a radical style, because it's recommending, first of all, which is so different from the way we were brought up, that it is okay to love yourself. First of all, put this first on the list. And that your love does not have to stop with that first circle of your near and dear, but can extend. So we will feel resistance when we embrace this practice. And I'll give you an example of what it sounds like. And the work is to press ourselves through the resistance and learn to feel the love for everyone and for ourselves that formerly we felt only for those for whom we have a preference. This is the end of preference. So it sounds like this when you do the actual practice. May I be happy. May those I love be happy. May those to whom I am indifferent be happy. May those with whom I have difficulties be happy. May all beings be happy. May I be free of suffering, and so forth. And you can put any phrases you want in there. I describe this in the book as one of the practices. But the reason I'm bringing it up today is because our topic will take us into this. And this is like a background that helps us understand where what we'll be saying today comes from. And this practice helped me very much. And I didn't really find an equivalent of it in our own tradition. So it was really helpful to find it in Buddhism. Any questions about this practice or how it works? So you do this on a daily basis. And then you do it throughout the day. Someone is, let's say, upsetting you, instead of saying, may he get his, you're switching it to may he calm down, may he find happiness, may he be enlightened, wherever you want to put it. So it's a way, if you can ask your question at the microphone, it's a way of opening yourself to a style that takes you beyond what we were brought up with. Because we were brought up with a lot of preference, exclusivism. Our love and loyalty is only for the people who deserve it, or who are our relatives or friends. And this makes everyone equal. That's why it's radical, because it's so egalitarian.
Isn't the equivalent the Jewish tradition of love your neighbor as yourself?
Yes.
As is the Christian tradition?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That fits really well. In fact, I'm glad he brought that up, because I did want to begin with a wonderful quotation. I'm on page 16 of our book, How to Be an Adult in Love. And this is a very unusual quotation, but I really like it. Flavius Josephus is an ancient historian who lived at the time of Christ. He is a Roman Jew. And this is his statement. I suppose it will become evident that the laws in the Torah, Jewish law, are meant to lead to a universal love of humanity. He's saying precisely this. So I'll read it once more. I suppose it will become evident that the laws in the Torah are meant to lead to a universal love of humanity. Not just love of the other chosen people, but universal. And then I've added to that, for the laws of the Torah, we can substitute our spirituality, our psychological work, our religion, our schooling, our political party, our nation, our family, relationships, commitments. In fact, there is nothing that does not have this ever-widening scope as its purpose. So everything now that I'm doing, even when I work on myself psychologically, it's so that I can become better at loving and extending the love so that it's universal rather than limited. And this too is a radical approach.
I agree with what Don said, the question. But love your neighbor as yourself, from my experience, I didn't love myself appropriately.
Yeah.
And so I was loving with my family and my neighbor. And it's also going through woundedness. So unless you're loving yourself appropriately, you're going to project that, or at least that's what I do.
Yeah. In other words, it'll be hard to love others if you don't know how to love yourself also. For instance, just loving yourself would be the equivalent of just love those who are in my family and who are my friends. That's my extended self. This extends yourself, S-E-L-F, so that it includes all the human family. It isn't limited to our own. You would have to start here with loving yourself. And it would have to be okay. This was another thing from this practice that was a little different from the way we were taught. Because we were taught always put your neighbor first. Mm-hmm. And this gave permission to put yourself first on the list. It's not being selfish. It's just that you begin where you are, and this is where you are. Yourself, your body. And then you look out and see other people. So it does make sense. Hi.
As you have been talking about this, I'm more and more seeing that evolving with the practice into a spiral.
Yes. Yes, it's a spiral. Good.
It's eternal, right. Infinite spiral.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
It just...
That would have more of a flow to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Loving kindness, equal, alive, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. That really helps. Hi, John.
Could it be that sometimes avenging would be the right thing at the right time for the right people?
Well, say more about what you mean.
Well, I was listening to a report on NPR.
Or did I make a mistake this whole past?
It's a sharp contrast to this special on NPR about a group of concentration camp survivors who took it upon themselves to avenge what had happened to them in the camps. And when I was listening to this, I thought that has a certain amount of rightness to that. There's a certain amount of truth to what they took on. And what they did was basically they found out who the concentration camp personnel were, and they finished them off.
Well, this doesn't quite fit with our style.
No. But my reaction...
I understand what you mean. Go ahead, John.
Well, it's just the sense that for that person, it seemed like the right thing.
Well, it's just not an evolved way of doing it. It stays at the level at which the crime happens. They're getting back at me for being a Jew, and I'm getting back at them for being a persecutor of Jews. It doesn't spiral out in a radical way to a new way of being.
Mm-hmm.
So the alternative would be what Bishop Tutu set up. He's the Episcopal bishop in South Africa. He set up the reconciliation style, where the whole community gets together and the people who caused harm stand up and admit what they did and ask for forgiveness, and then they are and they make some kind of amends, and then they're restored to the community. That is our style, and it really can happen. So, any other questions about this part? And by the way, the love your neighbor as yourself, they did not mean the man next door. The word neighbor means all the other members of the community. Secondly, love your neighbor as yourself has two meanings. The first meaning is love your neighbor equally as you love yourself. That's one option. But the other option is love your neighbor as if your neighbor were an extension of yourself, so that the whole human family is one extension of who you are, rather than we're all separate beings. Because that is more of a one-down style.
Hi. Maybe you're going to talk on this later, but I'm wondering about sometimes we associate like loving and being kind with being nice. And sometimes loving someone might not be interpreted or perceived as being nice. And you have that, like, the ouch kind of stuff.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit on, you know, stuff like setting boundaries and the times when loving someone might not seem like what we're used to. That, like, firmness.
Yes. And I think, yeah, it's like, yeah, tough love is the style that you're describing. It would be that love is not just making nice. It's always coming from your truth. And you're always able to state it. And then you're able to state your boundaries too.
In your chapter 8, I give a fabulous quotation from Martin Luther King, which I think is an excellent response to the question that Tom posed.
Okay, what page are you on?
On page 171. From his sermon, Loving Your Enemies.
Hold it one sec. 171. Yes, I was going to quote that anyway, so let's just read it now. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure it. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will. We shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at midnight and beat us and leave us half dead, we shall still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. And one day we will win our freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. So that's a person who really understood the gospel message. That's what it sounds like. A little bit crazy. Sounds that way. And that's going to be part of our topic today, which I consider the most exciting of all the topics we've talked about. It's how we move beyond just our near and dear to far and wide. And, yes, go ahead. Good morning.
I understand what you just were teaching, what you just gave us. And sometimes, you know, if you're watching the news and you see these things like that very troubled man or two men who attacked that young man to death in London. And I usually, when I hear the sirens go off, I just make all these silent calls. Please send an angel, minister unto the sick, send the angels to escort the people to the destination and all that. But how do you pray for these people? Well, this morning, because you have to, if you're going to do that, you have to pray for that person too. If you're really going to outpicture these kind of belief systems. So I just prayed that the men will come to understand the truth, and that they will see the light. But it's still very hard to pray for somebody who's doing stuff like that. And I think it's human to not want to.
Mm-hmm.
But,
I agree.
But that, you know, it's just so difficult these days when you see what people are doing. And it just seems to go outside the scope of human understanding, you know.
Well, I think you're bringing up a good point, which is that there is a deep inclination in us that goes all the way back to caveman times that has a repertory of disgust toward those who do evil things and a will to retaliate against them and to hurt them as they have hurt others. In other words, to repeat against them what they have done to you or others. And this inclination that's in every single human is deeply imbued in all the cells of our body. So when you have that feeling of disgust or even hate toward people who do such terrible things, it's normal to have the feeling of being turned off and even wanting them to suffer for what they did. But a new calling has come to us that shows us that there's something else inside us that can override the disgust and turn it to compassion, that can override the will to retaliate and turn it into prayerful, caring about the transformation of the other rather than retribution. And under this calling, is a trust in the Holy Spirit that has the power to convert and to change people no matter how evil they are. Underneath the caveman inclination is not the Holy Spirit. It's the most primitive fear that we ever experienced. It's the fear that those terrible things will happen to us. It's the fear that that same inclination to hurt others might be in us also. So it makes us want to turn against those who do the evil things to show that we are different so that we won't have to confront the fear that we're ultimately the same, given the right circumstances. And in exchange for the fear of being hurt is the Holy Spirit giving the power to endure hurt for the sake of this greater calling that has come to us. And we are so fortunate that such a calling came. And the voices that brought it were Buddha, Christ, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa. They showed us, wait, you don't have to be like Cro-Magnon. You can be like the evolved human, the new humanity that's trying to emerge, of which, in our tradition, Christ was the exemplar. Everybody follow? So always trust that you have both in you, that there's something in you that wants to do it the caveman way, but there's also something in you that wants to do it the Christ Buddha way. St. Francis, so forth. Jim?
I've been following the Judy Arias trial, a woman who committed one of the most horrendous crimes I've ever heard of. And the jury is now deliberating whether to give her the death sentence or life in prison. And her female attorney, Jennifer Wilmot, was arguing and asking the jury to give her a life in prison. And she said, this is very profound. I never expected to hear this in this venue. And she said, we are all more than our worst deeds.
Good.
And she was arguing that her life still had value.
Yes.
And
we're more than our worst deeds. So that's the equivalent of saying there's the possibility of transformation in everyone, no matter what they've done. And so we're, instead of being overwhelmed by how bad they are, we're trusting, this comes from the Spirit, that there's always the possibility of conversion, there's always the possibility of change of some kind, of making amends. And it doesn't mean that the person will be restored to society, but it changes our way of relating to what justice is about. So instead of it being about retribution, it comes to represent restoration. So always we have both in us. This, what I have written here about the caveman style, which is based on fear, and this set of inclinations about retaliating and so forth, this will always be a choice, and this will be the one that the most primitive part of your brain will automatically go to. And when we have been converted to the way of peace and transformation, gradually, as we keep acting in accord with that side of ourselves, it kicks in instead of the primitive side. That would be the equivalent of you have evolved. You are an evolved human. Instead of you're just carrying on what you inherited from your primitive ancestors.
John? What has helped me sort this out is illustrated in a quote by Gandhi that it has to do with not really a victory per se, like a competition, but more like this, and I'll have to paraphrase this quote, and you've discussed it, actually, you've alluded to it. It's not the person, but it's the person's evil that we are to heal, and that it is our role to free the person and elevate the person.
Mm-hmm. It's a radical calling. And remember that even though we have a belief that the style of our calling to love is powerful, it's not embraced as a strategy. So if it doesn't work, we don't give up, because we realize that we live in a world that sometimes overcomes the good for a while. Sometimes evil comes to the surface and seems to submerge the good. Ultimately, we believe that the good will triumph. But you can't think of this as, well, I'll do this because it works. You do this because this is who you've become through your conversion to the way of Christ. And the only food that helps you get there is the Eucharist and the communion that it represents.
David, what I find helpful is when I want to act in a loving, kindness way, but my primitive brainstem is not cooperating, and I know it's not going to go there at that moment, I go to the place of loving intentions. Because my intention is to go to that place. I just can't get over that hurdle in this moment. Therefore, I don't feel that I'm less than, or feel shameful or guilty, because my intention is good.
Yes, I like that. And that's all we really have, is the purity of our intention. Because we all go to this caveman style. Sometimes on a daily basis. But we're working at it. And we're intending to move toward light. And that's the equivalent of success in our spiritual practice. Okay, well, good. I'm glad we talked about this. It changes the idea of the hero's journey. The hero's journey in recent years has been thought of as personal. I'm on a journey through my life. We want to open that up now. It's no longer a personal journey. It's the journey of all humanity. And I'm cooperating in how we all get to the goal. Something like the Buddhist Mahayana style, in which the enlightened person says, I will not enter nirvana until I can take all of humanity with me. Imagine what an advanced experience of love is behind that statement. I have my quote by Darwin on 165. I'll just quickly read it. As people advance in civilization and small tribes are united into larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he ought to extend his social instincts and sympathies to all members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him. So even from a scientific point of view, it makes sense, since we live in a world that's now so linked and connected. Like today, for instance, I heard on the radio, the stock market has gone down because the Japanese stock market went down. And then they interviewed somebody and he said, the Japanese stock market went down because the Chinese stock market went down. And I thought, this is an example of how we're all connected now. No longer separate arrangements. Well, let's go on to our main topic for today, which is this over-the-top way of loving. Now I'm on page 166. And this will be a question for us. How far can we go with this? Because what you're about to hear about the self-sacrifice may sound a little bit outrageous, but I think it's good for us to look at this part of our subject. Over the top means more than what's required, more than what's expected or considered necessary. It's the idea of going the extra mile, turning the other cheek, even giving up our life and fortune for others. This is heroic agape. Agape is the self, the giving of self, the disinterested way of loving that's in the loving kindness practice. So I love everyone even though they don't, quote, deserve it. It's the end of deserving. No, others don't have to deserve our love. We just want to love everyone because that's our call. And there always have been teachers who recommended this form of loving. It's a powerful style based on reversing our natural instinct to look out for number one. And then I have my question, which is the question for today. Is this a foolish misunderstanding of love, or is this what love can really be in its highest, wisest form? Greater love than this no man hath, is to give his life for his friends. So altruism and self-sacrifice, they seem to be like top-down. I'm up here doing this for you. Love seems to happen in a context in which self and others are equal. And the only exception is in special critical moments when we do sacrifice our own safety, for instance, to rescue a drowning man. It could be that this kind of love is reserved for most of us only to those occasions. But then there have been people who acted in this counterintuitive way, don't protect my own life. And these are people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King that showed a self-sacrificing love not only in a crisis or for a cause. Love itself is the cause, because it is invariably about establishing connection. And these connections would be with everyone. Okay, question?
Yes. That kind of love almost feels like a mother's love.
Yes, it is motherly.
I once said to my son, who was 10, I don't know if this was wise or not, but I said, you know, I would die for you.
Yeah.
And he said, but Mom, I wouldn't die for you. And I said, you're not supposed to. I said, and I don't know where it came from, but that sense of that overwhelming, over-the-top love, and it goes beyond the prefrontal cortex or anything rational or logical. I think that really is one of the ultimate loves.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, and that certainly fits. So we don't have to go to the hero stories. We can just go to the depth of maternal love. And we have felt that as parents, that our children were so dear that we would give up everything for them. And you're right, it does have more of a maternal style. This explains why when God wanted to do some testing, he asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, Isaac. He wouldn't dare ask Sarah, the mother, because he would have gotten a go to hell, Mr. Thank you for bringing that up. And I wanted to give this quotation by Gandhi on 168. The religion of nonviolence is not meant for the enlightened people and the saints. It's meant for the common people. So he's saying it's not a special calling. Everyone can be like this in his or her own little realm of the universe. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I think that love can also be an entity completely outside of yourself and can come quite unexpectedly. I remember, it was some years ago, 15 or 20, I read in the New York Times, I think it was in the magazine section, about a woman who was jogging in a park and she was grabbed by a group of young black men and stripped and about to be raped. And she said, I don't know where this came from, but I looked up at the man who was on top of me and suddenly I loved him. And I looked into his eyes. And he got up, and the others all helped her put her clothes back on and helped her home. And that was that love that just welled up. Imagine being able to love your rapist.
Yeah.
And to have it affect him so that it changed his whole intention. This is the real power of love.
Mm-hmm.
That sometimes we can love the most unlovable people when we have no intention of loving you. It pours into us at the right moment if we're open for that sort of thing. I keep praying that I will have that with anybody and everybody who offends my sense of social justice or who offends me personally, that I may make use of this outside power of life. Which is probably an inside power, but something which comes without my specifically calling upon it.
Yeah.
just be there.
Well, that's beautiful. So that person responded not from the amygdala, the primitive part of our brain that is on alert whenever there's danger and wants to hit back. It came from the divine life inside. Okay, so I gave the example in here of the Good Samaritan, so I just wanted to say a word about that story. As you know, it's about the Jews and the Samaritans were enemies of each other, like the present-day Israeli and Palestinians. So a Jew equivalent of an Israeli was attacked by robbers and stripped, as you just mentioned, Jackie, same idea, and left on the wayside to die. And two Jews walked by without helping him. And then, equivalent of a Palestinian, Samaritan came. He bound up the wounds, and then he brought him to an inn, left him with the innkeeper, and said this: "Look after him, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have." That's the over-the-top extra expense. I will pay you for whatever is over and above what I've given you. It goes beyond what's expected. It transcends the ordinary limitations that we place on giving and caring. So if we were to join the journey of the Good Samaritan, we would become impartial in how we show concern. So we would feel compassion for the victims, and we would also feel compassion for the perpetrator. We'd be willing to give an equal measure to strangers as to our nearest and dearest. It doesn't mean we love everyone in the same way, because we love our children differently from the way we love strangers, but the Good Samaritan crosses the line and shows that love to a stranger can be shown with the same generosity as love within the family, because there's a solidarity with the human family, even if it would be unilateral. So he isn't getting anything in return, but he's still doing this. Does this follow for everybody? Any questions? Keith? Yeah, go ahead. No, stay right there. No. Yeah.
Recently, Nancy and I heard a woman speaking who runs a program in Northern Ireland, reconciliation and healing. She had an insight I'd never thought of before with the Good Samaritan story, saying that, you know, we also have to learn how to be innkeepers, the long-term caregivers for the people who have been injured and hurt.
Mm.
It just really struck me. I had never thought of that.
Yeah. And the innkeeper was willing to take care of him, thinking to himself, well, the guy may never come back.
Yeah.
But I'll still take care of it. Good. Thank you, Keith. The story shows that people can cross the line from only taking care of their own to taking care of anyone. That's what this over-the-top style is about. So in our class so far, we've talked about how to love yourself, how to love others. Now it's, is there something in us that can go the one step further and either show love in a more heroic way or show it far and wide or to the people who seem the least apt candidates? There will no longer be apt candidates. There will no longer be a set of principles by which someone becomes deserving. You're doing this because this is who you've become. What have you become? The same as what God has been described as. God is love. So, that since God is not somewhere up in the sky, but a a deep reality of my own being and of all beings, then to say God is love is the same as to say that's what I am too. Although, unfortunately, the way this body is constructed as of the year 2013, it's still connected cellularly to the old fears and styles of our original ancestors. So the work will be to release ourselves from that little by little, and the more individuals do it, the more will there be a kind of new specific gravity, and humanity itself might change. So that people will start being born who don't just automatically go to the amygdala primitive response of hurt back, but start to see options. That will be the next step. Everybody follow? Okay, let's have one final question, then we'll take our break.
I find that when I react that way in this new kind of over-the-top love,
yeah,
I get a lot of response back from friends who say, "What are you doing? How, you know, why are you being kind to this person? Why are you taking care of this person when this person has been so evil and mean to you?"
Yeah.
So.
Well, that is the kind of question you'll be asked.
And I found myself asking myself that question: why am I? And my response was, well, I wanted to be more Christ-like, but I'm not sure if that's...
Okay. No, that's a beautiful answer. Let me give an answer that occurs to me from the story of Franz Jägerstätter. You've heard of him. He's now a saint. Franz Jägerstätter was a farmer in Germany during World War II, a Roman Catholic, and he worked as a sexton in the little local village church. When the war was in progress, he was drafted into the German army. He refused to go. He said, "This war is immoral, and I will not participate." So he was put into jail. And while he was in jail, since he was such a simple soul and such a loving kind of person, everybody could see how ingenuous he was. Even his jailers were very moved by him. They worked with the authorities and they said, "Hey, we arranged it that if you join the army, we can get you a desk job. You won't have to be out in the field. You won't have to kill anybody. But please go along with this." He said, "No, any participation at all is just not right. It's still participating in evil." So they brought the parish priest, and he explained the idea that even though the war seems unjust, he gave this kind of traditional, kind of old-fashioned Catholic view. The sin will be on the heads of those who give the orders, not on the heads of those who follow them. He didn't accept that either. They finally brought the bishop to try to convince him. And this is what he said, and I quote, and this is fitting what you're bringing up. He said, "Reverend sirs, I appreciate how you're trying to save me, but you were not given the grace that I was given to do this. And so I have to follow the grace that I was given. And no explanations will change my mind." Isn't that beautiful? That's a wonderful courage that can only be ascribed to the power of the Holy Spirit. So he was finally executed, and in recent years, the German government reversed his said he was not really guilty. And then he was canonized a saint by the recent pope. But anyway, he's a model of the taking a stand, and even when someone proves to you that you're not really acting in a healthy way, you believe so much in the grace that was given to you to do it differently, even though it doesn't make sense to the rest of the world, that you don't give up. And there's something about that that's very admirable. It's not everybody's calling, but every once in a while someone comes along that really shows us that that there is something in us that can transcend this primitive style. I remember once in the seminary asking the question, how do we know that following the Catholic style really works to make you a more enlightened person? And he gave a beautiful answer. He said, you know it by the lives of the saints. If it worked to make a St. Francis, it worked to make a Franz Jägerstätter, then there must be something about it that's useful. Of course, it also made a lot of messed up people. But but at a higher level, it seems to have worked. All right, let's take a short break.